Yes. When you adjourn, the question was asked to or busy in the other committee, while the senior committee, the senior house was too busy. Welcome. I don't know when to start in responding to questions. Questions were put to justice and SAPS, and some to social development. We want to get some responses. If I can make this plea, that can we be so kind and avoid preambles and just respond to questions? Don't motivate the order because I think it's my friend over here. Yeah, can we try this time? Let's leave out the preambles. Just go straight to those questions. Who wants to start first? You want to start this? Okay, over to you.
Thank you, Chief. The first question related to the connectivity between Home Affairs computers and the South African Police Service. We have an arrangement with Home Affairs in terms of which we can obtain information from Home Affairs, but to have an integrated system directly connected with them and allowing us to do searches, that is something which is part of the future, and at this stage it is still under investigation. The second question by the Honourable Ntuli was related to the bail system and the problem that the community experience in the sense that the person is arrested and then tomorrow released on bail, and then the danger that the person may be attacked by a mob of people because they are unhappy with the fact that he's been released. Now, this is a problem that we are experiencing. For that very reason, in the South African Police Service, we have established a system of community police forums, and one of the objectives of a community police forum is to ensure communication between the South African Police Service and the community, to explain to them these kinds of phenomena so that they will understand the reason and the importance on why people should be released on bail. But it's a long-term process, and if there are any proposals from the committee on how we can actually move forward and increase or speed up the process of assisting the community to understand it, that will be welcome. The second question from the Honourable Member from the Merwe, relating to Songhouse, I presume that will be answered by the Department of Social Development. All that I can say is that the problem of three children, as far as the police is concerned, is really a serious problem. And it is something where a concerted effort will be needed in order to actually address the problem. Then the question by the Honourable Nyanda relating to the station commissioner, who was unable to read what he wrote in the register or what somebody else wrote in the register. It is a problem that we are trying to assist our members to actually, when they make recordings in the register, to do it properly. But it's a long-term process, and I apologize for the inconvenience that was caused in those circumstances. The remark relating to the Home Affairs computer, in terms of which a person was certified to have died while he was still alive, it is one of the reasons why we are very careful in how we utilize information that we get from Home Affairs. Chair, these are actually the only questions relating to the service. I believe the other departments can respond on the rest.
Thank you very much. Maybe I can go to social development before I go back to justice. There were concerns raised by members here. I hope you got the questions. that as we are speaking, we don't seem to know where are these probation officers, the role they're playing in making sure that some of these laws we are passing are implementable. Because as we are speaking now, if you look into what's going to happen now when this bill becomes an act, there'll be more work for you than what you're seeing now. And my experience tells me that as of now, we're not coping in dealing with the assessment, the monitoring, and all these other things. I wonder what's going to happen now when this bill becomes an act. During last time, Honorable Julie raised some very serious questions that unfortunately I couldn't respond to. But you've got all the questions. I don't know. I've got the. This court said that the two of you are more than capable to handle all questions. Let me hear. I wonder why. I didn't hear any question to NPA today. What's happening with this today? Why NPA, you're leaving. Ukhombisa to just sit here. No, you can't just sit here and not do some work. No, you can't. Especially for me, I'm surprised why you let NPA just say, just like that. Because yesterday they were, it's not NPA who were saying there's a prima facie case. It was the same thing. Right. Can we get some responses from social development before? Hey, the prima facie case.
Thank you, Chair. I will start with the last question that you have asked in relation to the capacity of DSD. Osconi yesterday gave a breakdown of the things that will happen in preparation for the implementation of the bill when it's enacted. Okay, currently, we are saying as a social development, as a department, that we have 484 probation officers countrywide. And these numbers are not geographically spread equally. For example, Eastern Cape has 118 probation officers. And when you go to Limpopo, there are only 22. And then Northwest, 20-something. Gauteng, 79. KZN, 49. You can imagine all these are the total number that we have. Is just a breakdown of the 484 that they are not geographically spread. The bigger province like KZN, for example, which you will expect to have more than 100 probation officers, they have less than 50 probation officers. But be it as it may, that we also have the total number of within the country in order for us to implement this bill, this piece of legislation which is a bill, the Children's Act, the Probation Services Act, all in all the country needed more than 11,000 social workers for all these bills to be in 1 year. So all of the things that I'm just indicating is that all these pieces of legislation require a social worker. Hence, it has been declared a scarce skill in the country. So generally, the generic social workers in the country, there are more than 8,000 that are busy, that are implementing the Children's Act on its own, doing all necessary, be it foster care, adoption, and all other forms. But these are dedicated personnel that are dealing with probation services for children in conflict with the law, are only 484, servicing the whole country. That is the challenge that we have. But in terms of the capacity and the plan that the department has, we have indicated that in the next MTF cycle, we have requested an additional 484 probation officers. And over and above that, currently we have 264 assistant probation officers who assist the probation officers in some of the duties that they are supposed to be done. And in the next MTF cycle, we are saying we'll add 772 assistant probation officers to assist in that regard. What we have already done as a department to date, we have sent a sector bid to National Treasury to request. We have sent the sector bid to the National Treasury to request additional funding for the capacity. This is exclusive. This is excluding the infrastructure. This is including information management and all those two. But when it comes to personnel, what we have requested now to National Treasury, we are requesting in the next 3 years 245 million rand for the improvement of the capacity, be it a psychologist, be it occupational therapist, be it all to cater for the needs within those secure care facilities and child and youth care centers and the capacity within. That is how we are coming up, where we are trying to start that. And that is part of the recruitment drive that the department has done. Is the retention and the recruitment and retention strategy that the department has. As my supervisor has indicated yesterday, that in this financial year we have 1,917 new recruits of social workers who are studying social work in all the universities in the country. So next year we have, the department again has set an amount of 210 million to recruit additional. So when the bill kicks in April 2010, to a certain extent, because all these recruits that we are talking about, other students are in course 3, others are in course 1, not necessarily at the same level. So there are others who were already studying on their own, but we assisted them to finish their studies. So out of those who will be able to take most of them to join the department in terms of the recruitment drive that we have. That is my response to the first question related to the capacity and what the department has been doing. Secondly, there was a question related to the pre-sentence report, what a probation officer ought to do and what are the challenges that, you know, the honorable member indicated. What does the probation officer do? We as the probation officers, in compilation of the pre-sentence report, we make up the recommendations. And that recommendation takes into consideration the circumstances, the offense, the victim, and the availability of program. That informs what it is that, you know, you have taken all the necessary information into that account, and then you bring it before the court. You make that recommendation that this child might and will benefit if placed under this, where there is this child and youth care facilities with all these programs available that will be able to be a rehabilitative in nature. So we make recommendations to court, but these are untested versions. It's an untested version from the offender side and from the victim side. So when we bring it to the court, that's where the court weighs the option. So we make recommendations to court, then the court decides on the best options of what we have recommended on. So we might not, as a department, have the control over to say, no, if my report, I'm saying I wanted this child to be placed under this, given all the sentencing options, we have considered them given all the circumstances, but the court will use all the options in terms of, they will have to subject that into testing within the court system, and then therefore the recommendation might be outrightly rejected or discarded. But Section 79 again provides, in terms of that, you know, any reasons must be provided why there was that rejection and why that sentence was not taken as an option. You will also recall that in terms of our discussion since yesterday, one of the things that had happened was the issue of the monitoring, not necessarily to use the word invasion. And in the two chapters that we have just read now, starting from section 73, section 74 up to 79, it has been coming up very clear every now and then that, you know, a probation officer must monitor and monitor compliance. Secondly, after monitoring the compliance, you also have to present a progress report to court in a prescribed manner. So that is where our role comes in to say, no, from time to time, it's the court order that gave us to say, no, we must monitor, and how we sure should monitor it is one area that is an area of concern, as it has been raised by the honorable members in this regard, to say, no. But court will have given us an indication to say, if it's monitoring of a child, it might take a form of maybe twice a week or three times a week, and the times and schedule for those will be also be indicated very clearly, that the probation officer will do that, and even the assistant probation officer will be monitoring. But therefore, failure on our side for a probation officer to comply with the court recommendations is a contempt of court. So therefore, for us, as again we are saying, you know, the probation officer must comply with the requirements what the court has ordered us to do and compile a report. And it's on that basis, and it's on the basis of that report that will again assist in the determination of the future of the very same child that is in question. I don't know whether I have said. I think the last aspect that I wanted to address relates to the issues of the street children, as SAPS has indicated. One of the key elements is that, you know, street children issues is a worldwide phenomenon and it's on increase. But as a department, we didn't sit down and fold our arms in terms of that. What we have programs in place. We have shelters in place and drop-in centers that are being provided for children who are living on and off the street. The Children's Amendment Act of 2007 made a provision for the Department of Social Development to provide the services. What we have at National Department is that the directorate or the chief directorate for children services have also established a directorate that deals with children, the children in need of care in particular. They have a unit that specifically deals with that. That also includes the issue of human trafficking and so on in this regard. So we have systems and programs in place in regard of the street children. But having said that, in reality out there, when we walk out of this parliament or today from this committee, we might find that there are children who are under the bridge, somewhere roaming around the street unsupervised, which is the true reality of what is happening down there. The question might be, you know, when you are saying you have programs and things in place, are they user-friendly? Or in a way, are we winning in the fight against the very same issues of the protection of the children as we regard them as vulnerable groups? That's another question that we can pose to the department. But necessarily, I wanted to say, no, there are programs in place. Thank you, Chair.
Madam Nesdo, any addition from you?
I think he has said a mouthful for all and for capacity, including the issue of probation officers supposed to monitor children in whatever program or like it has been stated, where they will have to monitor children either in a family order, family time order, or family group conference, or for victim offender mediation, or what is stated here in the bill is some of the programs that are in the bill now are tested even though they are not there in all the areas, but we are already doing what is in the bill. We might not be doing it in the peripheries, like in the rural areas, but we have in our rural areas, which is not legislated, where we will even use our forces, our traditional leaders, to assist in terms of whatever cases in the area. And most of our prosecutors and our magistrates, they do know the situation, and based on that, we will divert or we will place that child in that particular program, which actually, for me, it strengthens the family relationships, and emphasis for us is that there should be, families should be preserved. And by placing children in the communities, really, somehow it's not difficult to take back the child from prison to the community. But for the child who has been serving the sentence in the community, it's so easy for that child to retain that relationship with whoever the child wronged. Thank you.
There are more questions than answers. I'm sure I've done. I'm sure. Justice, want to listen to you.
Okay, one of the questions was what happens where the parent or the child is unable to pay a fine. I think that was with regard to Clause 74. If you look at Clause 74, subsection 2, it provides an alternative where the court has considered and found out that the child or the parent is unable to pay the fine. The court may impose an alternative to a fine, and the alternatives are listed in subsection 2 as a symbolic restitution or a payment of compensation, or the court can impose an obligation on a child to provide some services on the victim or to a group of people or to a community or a charity, or any other option that the court may think that will fit or be appropriate for the circumstances. And the second question was with regard to the monitoring. Sections 72, 73, and 74, which are almost all restorative and community-based sentences, provide their own monitoring provision, where the court will have to identify a probation officer to monitor the compliance of the child with the sentence. Section 78, which I think Honorable Mzisi was worried about, is regarding the postponement of suspension of a sentence, is provided for or is done in terms of Section 297 of the Criminal Procedure Act. And this section contains its own monitoring procedure, which is almost similar to the other provisions in the bill. But it's not provided for in the bill because it's provided in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act. The last question regarding the pre-sentence report, I think my colleagues from Social Development have covered it. But I just want to mention that if you look at the section, it's the court that would have requested the probation to compile the report. Subsection 4 is just there as a discretion to the court, and I think we should have faith in our court system that the court, as the court would have requested the precedence report, would consider the report and would not easily deviate from the recommendations of the probation officer.
Madam Kosan Ayodan. Now, there was a task given to Shireen, but it looks as if she's being undermined. And, you know, she gave instructions to people to come before the committee. Now they just left. I wonder if they said bye-bye to her, you know. No, no, on a serious note, sir. No, the Serbs people, those who were here, they said no, that they didn't make any other arrangement. They thought they were finishing today, this thing. So they said their flight is now. But because this is the justice deal, but I said it's fine, this one can leave, but they must send someone to come tomorrow, Friday and Saturday. So they'll send someone to come for those 3 days when we'll be sitting here. So don't be surprised when they leave. You know that they are undermining. They spoke to yours truly. So I agree that they can leave, but as long as they'll send someone tomorrow, it's okay. So don't be surprised, colleague. But any question, as I know, Philip is here, you know, he's going to take whatever question he'll give it to them, you know. Even though he came here for the other bill, but if there are questions, as I know, Sharon has done well up until now to give them their questions, even though they were not here. And they were able to capture exactly what you asked, colleague. So even now, feel free to ask any questions to SAPS or whatever they'll respond. Before that, I'll busy responding to questions. I'll allow you to come in. Let me allow them to exhaust our questions. They will come in the next round of questions. Yes, Sherry.
Yeah, I just wanted to perhaps add to some of the responses. And I think when you look at the Child Justice Bill, there are far more options now available than is currently under the Criminal Procedure Act in terms of this bill. As an example, if you just look at sentencing, you have the option of going into prison at the moment. And you would have, which is what some presiding officers, when they are creative, would give you the option of a postponed or a conditional sentence so that you may not necessarily serve your time in prison and meet out your sentence somewhere else, and or the option of correctional supervision. So when you look under the part on sentencing options, there are now more options available than there was before. So one has to look at it in that particular context. And also when looking at just the whole issue of fines, there are other options that have to be considered and programs that are being put in place to ensure. At the moment, there's quite a bit that has been implemented and piloted and tested so that when we have the legal framework in place, which we didn't have, we are then able to say, here's some of the challenges we faced and here's the mechanisms we will put in place to respond to the issues. Again, on several of the questions, I think what's coming through from my analysis of it is the question of implementation. You will see in terms of this bill, it is the first piece of legislation that has a very strong monitoring framework. And I know over lunchtime we were debating about the effectiveness of this. There has been no other, with the exception of the criminal law, the sexual offences amendment, has not been as extensive a monitoring framework in the piece of legislation. Usually that has been left to policy and regulations. But if you look at the section under the responsibilities, functions, and duties of the Intersectoral Committee, you will see that in terms of 96, the implementation of the priorities and strategies contained in the national framework is what that committee will be responsible for. So a question like a pre-sentence report, and the reason why it's put there, because that provision is in existence at the moment in terms of the current Criminal Procedure Act. And what would happen if I use that as an illustration now is a magistrate who currently has that discretion to disregard a probation officer's report, which probation officer would have exhausted and investigated the environment of the child before making their pronouncement in court and submitting it as evidence. A presiding officer would be able to say, I'm sorry, I'm not satisfied with this report, or I don't like something in there. And you have the usual complaints of the probation officer didn't provide as comprehensive a report as possible. Of course, the probation officers have their view as well as to magistrates just disregard us because they don't think take us seriously, etc. The reason why that particular provision, which is additional, says you must record the reasons for why you've changed your mind over and above what is a fully investigative report, is to monitor them. And if you look under 96 sub E, Roman numeral 8, sentencing, is to then monitor, is this coming from a particular magistrate who may be averse to ever wanting to consider probation officer's reports? Is there a particular pattern? How are you analyzing what the challenges are? What this will also do for us, and currently is in operation in terms of the intersectoral committee that we have and has been running for a bit, so all we've done is now put the legal framework to give us more more teeth, as it were, to then say, well, we're finding that it's one particular jurisdiction that is coming up with this. So we are able then to intervene directly. At this point in time, if a presiding officer decides, I don't like the report, there's no reason for recording that. You've also got the automatic appeal and review of matters. And at the moment, you find that where we see in the different magisterial jurisdictions something that is a bit peculiar, you'll find that, you know, whenever those matters go up for review, some questions being raised at this level. So that's almost giving us more support than we ever had prior. Again, when I look at just from some of the other concerns about monitoring, because a big question is implementation, is, and when we get to the part on just what has been in practice, as I said to you, the intersectoral committee thus far has been in existence for the last 10 years. But what this is giving to us now is that opportunity to measure our progress. And if you see further on, you will see that we've got to review our policy framework, which measures the progress on the achievement of the objectives, and also look at how the different departments work, either intersectorally, and then come up with the kind of information management system. And it's itemized, and you will see for any possibility that we may have excluded, because Roman numerals 1 to 10, I'm sorry, 11, pick up specific issues, because we've not had, as you heard Seth saying earlier, we've not had automated systems thus far. They've all been manual. We're in the process of putting automated systems, and this bill requires us, that is why the implementation date is 1st April 2010, and if you also look further, you will see that we must also have submitted our framework regulations, because this bill can't operate without its regulations, and it's the first bill ever to have done so. It will then say, it says so under Section 93, that we must submit our framework. The Cabinet Minister must submit it under subsection 2 within 2 months after the commencement of the Act and publish the framework. And also, we then have to review it as every within a period of 3 years. So before this bill, as with other rights, other pieces of legislation, where it's normally signed and then it comes into effect, we have got to have the systems in place by the first. In fact, technically, the bill says on the 1st of April 2010 it comes into effect, but for taking into account the period of time, technically we have to have everything in Parliament tabled, so the infrastructure must be in place by December 2009. So if you look at those particular sections, it requires, it's legally obligatory on us to have those in place. And in fact, the question was previously, do you have the capacity to manage all of the provisions in here? And we requested through the previous committee a staggered implementation, and then their compromise was no staggering. Even though we say progressive, we will see annually where you're going with this to measure progress, but then you have whatever is required in place by December 2009, technically. So it then requires on us to put the, I think there was a question from one of the members about, we want to see what is the prescribed, what do you mean when you say prescribed. Those regulations would have to have all been drafted, and we've got that period of a year. So it wouldn't happen that the bill will come into effect, and afterwards we can then put in regulations. It must all happen almost, what is the word? At the same time. Can't find the other word for it. I beg your pardon? Simultaneously, thank you. So I just wanted to capture those on the question of the implementation side. And when we get to our part in terms of implementation, we will just give you a highlight of many of the provisions that are already in practice in place.
Any other response? So there is a lot of questions. Yeah, I think so. No, they just flagged them for now. Then they said we will continue. They just flagged those questions. They will respond as a time. Anything from you, Lauren?
I had a look at my notes, and I think we've gone through all the questions that were raised before lunch, and I hope so.
Arable West?
Chair, this is a matter of interest. Seeing as a shortage of probation officers, I'd just like to know, what are the minimum qualifications necessary for a person to become a probation officer, or must that person just be acceptable to the courts? Thanks, Chair.
Yeah, I think let me allow this one, respond on this one before we go to the other hard stuff.
Yeah, thank you. A probation officer is a social worker, and the social work training in South Africa takes 4 years and must register with the council as a requirement, the minimum requirement. It's a 4-year training course, and then it's a degree. Then the second aspect of it is that, you know, to become a court official, there is an additional requirement of additional 2 years to be experienced in the field to work as a probation officer. That's the reason why we are not comparable with social workers in general. We have 8,000 social workers practicing as social workers in the country, but we have only 484 probation officers who are qualified to be the court officials, based on the experience of working within a course, because we can't just take it. A person is just from the university and put through him or her through the court system. He or she must start learning the ropes within the system of how the court system works, and then exposure, and then the supervision part of it. But after that, then that's the process to date within the department.
Colleagues, I think it's clear we're having a serious challenge as far as the provisional officers are concerned. We don't have them. I'm looking at KwaZulu-Natal. Big as it is, we had only 40 probation officers. It's a serious challenge. Serious challenge. I don't know. I'm looking at this coming 2 years as to whether this department, social development, will be able to cope with this load, you know. If they can't cope now, I don't know. We'll talk about this topic at later stage. This week still. I want them to unpack their plan, their strat plan on how to deal with this challenge. Because even if they can try to recruit this, they're still going to recruit. Not that people are at school, they're busy now, they're still going to recruit. Now I want to be tempted to allow Sister Ndazile to continue with the briefing. If there are questions that are still there, in this chapter, you know, I wanted to ask these questions, but something said, no, don't ask them. Must I ask them? Not now. Hmm? Honorable Mzuzu's questions he's saying were not responded to. Even though he commented for a long time before I asked his questions, he was just commenting before he came to his question. But if there are those who can still remember his questions, please just share notes so that you're able to respond to his questions. Compare those notes. Now, I want to bring your attention to the provision of Clause 65. Where a child has to be assisted by a parent. Now, let me flag these questions. I've got a question under Clause 65, 66, 67, and even 68, 72, 73, and 76. I've got questions on those clauses. I'm just giving a notice that I'll ask this question at some point. I'm just giving notice. Clause 77. I'm giving notice that I'll ask questions on those clauses. But I'll flag them for now because I want some of the questions will be linked to the legal reps that are going to be provided for these children. But I'm going to flag those questions for now until we get into this chapter. Because I want to link my questions to the following chapter, chapter 11. Colleagues, with your permission, can you allow Sister to continue with the briefing? Madam?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair. We're looking at chapter 11, still with legal representation. Clause 80 of Chapter 11 sets out the responsibilities of a legal representative when they represent children. And these include, as I've mentioned a few, the legal representative must allow the child as far as possible to give an independent instruction concerning the case. The legal representative must explain to the child's rights and duties in relation to the proceedings under the Act and must promote diversion where appropriate but may not unduly influence the child to acknowledge responsibility. The legal representative must uphold the highest standards of ethical behavior and professional conduct. And subclause 2 of Section 80 provides that a failure on the part of the legal representative to adhere to this requirement could result in the presiding officer making an order which could include an appropriate remedial action or a sanction, and also reporting the matter to the legal representative controlling body, such as the Law Society or the Bar or the Legal Aid Board. A legal representative is not prohibited from representing a child at a preliminary inquiry. Where a child appears in a child justice court and is not represented, the court must, in terms of clause 82, the court is obliged to refer the child to the legal aid board to apply for legal aid assistance. If the child declines legal representative or does not give instruction to a legal representative appointed, the court must record this. And a legal representative may be appointed to represent the child in terms of the legal aid board. And the clause also provides that the regulation will explain the manner in which a legal representative will assist the court in case where a child refused to give instruction or to decline to use his or her right to appoint a legal representative. That's
the provisions of Chapter 11. Okay, looking at Chapter 12, which deals with the appeals and automatic review of certain conviction and sentences, this chapter relies on the provisions of Chapter 30 and Chapter 31 of the Criminal Procedure Act, dealing with appeals and reviews. The presiding officer in a child justice court must inform the child of his or her right of appeal and the right to legal representation and the procedure to be followed. Although the provisions regarding appeal and automatic review relies on Chapter 30 and 31 of the Criminal Procedure Act, there are certain deviations. One of them is that in terms of this clause, a child who at the time of the commission of the offence was below the age of 16 or was 16 years or older but under the age of sentence of under the age of 18 years is sentenced to any form of imprisonment which is not suspended, he or she may note an appeal without having to apply for leave to appeal as required in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act. Regarding automatic review, there is a similar exception. Where a child at the time of the offence was below the age of 16 years or was 16 years or older but below 18 years and is sentenced to any form of imprisonment that is not wholly suspended or any sentence involving compulsory residence in a child and youth care centre, the sentence is subject to review by a judge in the High Court irrespective of the duration of imprisonment. In terms of the Criminal Procedure Act, it's only prison sentence which may exceed certain periods that are subjected to review. And that concludes Chapter 12. Okay, we are now looking at Chapter 15, which deals with expungement of criminal records. The bill provides that a conviction or a sentence of a child for a Schedule 1 or Schedule 2 offense may fall away after a period prescribed in the bill. The child must, however, apply to the Director General of the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development for the expungement of the records. Upon application, the Director General will issue a certificate of expungement directing that the conviction and sentence be expunged if the Director General is satisfied that the child complies with the criteria that is set out in this clause. For an offence listed in Schedule 1, the record of the conviction may be expunged after a period of 5 years. That is after the date of the conviction, unless the child has, during this period, been convicted of another similar offence or a more serious offence. For a Schedule 2 offence, the record may be expunged after a period of 10 years has elapsed after the date of the conviction. Again, this is unless the child has committed another crime during the period, another similar crime or a more serious offence. The Minister for Justice and Constitutional Development may, upon application, authorise the expungement of records before the time stipulated in this clause, before the 5 years for a Schedule 1 offence or 10 years for a Schedule 2 offence. If there are exceptional circumstances justifying the expungement. The head of the Criminal Record Centre of the South African Police Services must, upon receiving a certificate of expungement issued by the Director General of the Department of Justice, expunge the records and inform the child and confirm in writing to the child that the record has been expunged. The Director General for Social Development is responsible for expunging the records regarding the diversion. The expungement of any diversion order must be done on the date the child turns 21, unless the child has been convicted of any other offence or failed to comply with the diversion order. If an offence to expunge any of the records of conviction without the authority of the certificate of expungement as provided in this clause. The effect of expungement is that the conviction or the diversion order of the sentence is that the child is regarded as having no criminal record or no record of a diversion order, and this gives the child the opportunity to start on a clean slate, if I put it that way. And that concludes chapter 13.
I can see members are itching to ask questions, but can we hold it there? Let's allow her to continue. I'll tell you where she's going to stop. I'll tell you. My apologies, colleagues. She has been so good to us since yesterday. I think she deserves to be given this time also to finish her work. Standardly. Well, Mama. Well, Mama, we're good to get it. Do you agree? Continuously. If you need a break, it's fine. We can continue the questions. We can take a pause. We can pause now. You need a break. You need a break, man.
Yes.
Yeah, she needs a break. She needs a break. Shame. I understand. Now, let's engage from that chapter up until clause 87. All right? Honorable Mac, I saw your hand was up. Honorable Zizi, Honorable West, in that order.
Thank you, Chief. I would just like to have clarity, Chief. In the old bill, the age will be 7 years. Yeah? 7 years for conviction and all of that. It will raise to 10. Right? So if the new bill comes in, what happens with those convictions in between? Will it fall away? Will those records of those children fall away? Because there might be children in between then, between 7 and 10 that have been sentenced. Thank you, sir.
In that order. Thank you, Chairperson.
The flag question which they were still going to, if I may probably remind the department, it was based on the court may confirm, amend, or substitute a sentence. Now, I have asked this question purposely that we shall have a new set of rules in terms of criminal procedure, because I know that if a sentence has been passed and it was not carried out on that certain day, and in the next day, then the magistrate will have to send that for review so that it gets a fresh mandate from the review panel that, yes, you can pass sentence afresh. Now, here it seems as if then he can call in and do that, whether in the child's rights and justice court, that would be probably applicable. The other ones, I don't want to flag this, if they may answer at a later stage, it doesn't matter. On 79. The the question that arises here is compensation. If the court has actually ruled that the victim be compensated, in my mind, it does not, the shunting case, it is not there for the victim to go in the route of a civil matter, irrespective whether the parents, they refuse to compensate or not. How is that going to be treated? Because I think if it's the compensation, I can institute two sentences. If the court did not convict the person, I can still pursue in the civil matter. Now, in the compensation, what would happen? We did not going to probably open that case. The last question, sir, is on the 187. Yeah, it speaks of if a child has been convicted, and then there's probably a period of 10 years has now lapsed, can actually write to the Director General. Now, yet again there, I don't know whether this now probably would be having a new set of rules in terms of criminal procedure. Because in Section 84(1) in the Constitution, it's only the President that a person can apply for an expansion of records that is contained. Now, yeah, I see the Director General who could do that. Now, it seems as if the Child Justice Court is moving away. It will probably have its own set of rules. How it's going to operate, if probably that can be clarified to me. Because it brings a bit of a confusion if the Director General could also have that kind of a function. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Rishi. Chair, my question is the legal liability aspect. Let's say there's a child of 17 who has been arrested for rape or possibly a more serious offence, and he is convicted under Schedule 1 or 2, and he serves his sentence and is released, and then applies to have his criminal record expunged, and is then employed somewhere else and he commits the same crime again. What is the legal status of that person where he's committed that crime? Can that person then sue the state for, because he has got no possible way of checking on that person's record? Thanks, Jen.
Can we get responses?
Thank you. Mr. Mack's question, if I understood correctly, is the legal, the minimum age of criminal capacity is going to be 10, and it is 7 at the moment. What happened to those convictions? You're talking in terms of the expungement provisions? Or
Chair, just on the issue of the 7 to 10, remember this Act does not apply retrospectively, which I think is the question that you were querying, is does it mean that children who have been convicted already within the category of 7 to 10, will they be eligible to apply for an expungement of the criminal record, if that's what I understood you to ask?
You can repeat briefly your question.
If the child is above 10, 7, and the age limit is 7, and below 7, he doesn't have any criminal capacity. From 7 upwards, he has criminal capacity. Right? Now, on that basis, he is sentenced today. But tomorrow, the new bow comes in act, and that age moves to 10. Then from 10 downwards, there's no criminal capacity. So what then happens? Then that child may not be sentenced. That's how I understand it. Will he have a record? If sentenced, will that sentence continue? What happens then?
There is a transitional provision in the bill in terms of Clause 98, which provides that all the proceedings that are currently continuing now should be continued and concluded as if this had not been passed. So a proceeding that is continuing in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act should be continued and concluded in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act. So I think that should cover the question that is raised by the...
I think they might... Tanda's done that as far as part-heard cases are concerned, and I think that's correct. But if, let's say, the Act comes into operation... If a child commits an offence the day after the Act comes into operation, and the child is under 7, or is 7 years or under, that child will not have criminal capacity like a child who is under 10. But you're going to lose. There's got to be a cut-off point. You know, the legislation looks forward, so there's got to be a cut-off point. If a child
Okay, it's a principle in our law, if the Act makes it clear, that if you, and it's a criminal law principle, I think there was another one that is related to it, is that once the Act comes, this Act is not retrospective, so it's going to be, an unfortunate circumstance, similar to the Sexual Offences Amendment Act, the day after the definitions came in, whereas if you had have committed, if I use the very heinous example of rape, in the way it was previously defined the day before, you would still be then processed through the system under the old Criminal Procedure Act, because that is the day, and you need to know what is the offence you're committing at the period of time, and then the necessary consequences follow as the old piece of legislation. So it's just going to be a bit unfortunate because there is no retrospectivity. I think the one time we put retrospectivity in our law is for the Sexual Offences Register, where previous convictions, because of the bigger protection for children, will be brought into the current register in terms of the Amendment Act for sexual offences. But there is no provision here to be able to benefit under the expungement here, because it would have followed a whole different set of legal principles, and I think we would open ourselves up to all sorts of challenges. And I think it's similar to the question, I think, which I just wrote the response down, but if I'm trying to remember the example about once you've been convicted of an offence and then you commit another offence because you would have been expunged, it then is a new offence. You can't be brought back on an old offence if you've... Because you would find currently the situation with many people who would have... that is why you go back and look at previous convictions. It's different for children that if, you know, once you've gone, it give you a chance to start off on a new slate. But it doesn't mean now that you're never going to consider those. So it's a different issue. Because once you've been convicted, you've been convicted of an offence. Mike.
You see, he's not satisfied, but let's flag it. We'll come back with... later. Let's continue to sponsors.
Chairman, Mr. Mzizi's question, he was referring to Clause 79, and if I understand correctly, the child, do you have a concern that the Child Justice Court may confirm, amend, or substitute the sentence if the sentences that have been imposed do not work? That's nothing, just to give you the reassurance, I don't think it's entirely new. We've already got something like that, I think, in the Criminal Procedure Act for periodic imprisonment. a person that doesn't comply with periodic imprisonment can be brought back to the court and another sentence can be imposed. So what I'm trying to say, this is really nothing new. Does that, I just want to make sure that they have responded.
The point that you were raising, because Lawrence has covered it, the point you're raising is that a functus officio, once you've finished your matter and it's processed before you, you can't come back as the presiding officer and rehear the case. That's a completely different principle, because this one is, you remember, in terms of the way this bill is structured, your matter is still on the roll for the purposes of fulfilling that sentence, because it's a new regime that has been brought into in this bill. So it's, as you were saying, correct, that it's a new set of principles. So until you've complied with that particular sentence, your matter is technically still on the roll. Once you've completed the sentence, then only does it fall off the roll. So the presiding officer in this particular matter is merely hearing from the probation officer, has there been compliance? Can I take this off the roll? And only if that matter is off the roll, then does that presiding officer become functus officio, which is the principle that you were referring to. Is I've completed my function now as an officer. I can't revisit the matter.
And sure, on the expungement, Mr. Mzizi raised a question about pardon in Section 84 of the Constitution. Section 84 of the Constitution deals with presidential pardons. The expungement that we have in mind here doesn't constitute a presidential pardon, and they're two different processes. This is cleaning the criminal records at the SAPS Criminal Records Centre, is wiping the expunging, cleaning the criminal records, so that if you apply for a police clearance certificate, for instance, you'll get and you've sat out your 10 years and your 5 years, and you've committed no offence in between that time. You can get, and when you apply to the police criminal records centre, they can issue you that they will clean the record and issue with a certificate to say that there's no criminal record. But it doesn't constitute a presidential pardon. A presidential pardon is something different.
Yeah, can I just add to some extent the responses? Remember, these expungements for Schedule 1, Schedule 2, and it's on application. It does not mean that once you apply, you automatically, your record will be expunged. There's an application process where your application must then be considered. And so it does not mean automatically there's going to be an expungement if there is that concern, because a whole lot of factors will have to be taken into account before your application will be considered successful. So there'd have to be a whole process in place.
Okay, can I also add that on the question of expungement, that it's after a period of time, which is listed in the clause, and it's up to 10 years, and it's only for Schedule 1 and Schedule 2 offences, and serious offences listed in Schedule 3 are not covered in Clause 88. Can I just also then cover the question regarding compensation? It's not a new principle in terms of the bill. It's also covered in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act, where within the criminal procedure proceedings, the victim can request or be compensated. And it is the principle of our law, it does not allow double compensation. So where the victim has been compensated in terms of the criminal proceedings cannot go and institute a civil proceedings. So it won't be a double benefit to the victim, where the court has ordered compensation in terms of the criminal procedure. The victim will not be able to proceed with the civil proceedings.
I wonder if I'm the only one. This room is so cold. Hey, can something be done to this room? Hey, man. Sure. Yeah. Am I the only one? Okay. Oh, at least I've got sense. Yeah. Yeah. Members are murmuring about the responses. They're not quite comfortable with the responses, but because we're continuing, you'll remember your questions, Colette. You'll bring them again. It's fine, no problem. They will respond. Can we? I wanted us to deal with this remaining clauses, so that we
haven't answered Mr. Wirth, but I'd just like to confer with my colleagues, and then we'll get back, if we may, on that.
You can respond if you're ready. Not now. Not now. Okay. Yeah. As long as you don't take the worst question with it, we'll go back to Pretoria. But please, right. Colleagues, can we allow them to continue the briefing? Do you still need a break, Nazil, or are you fine now?
Fine, sir. This is the last chapter. Chapter 14, which contains general provisions. The first clause, clause 88, deals with the rules of court, in terms of which the Minister of Justice may make provision for the rules of court after consultation or upon consideration of the proposal put forward by the rules board, and the rules must be published in the Government Gazette before they are approved by the court. And then clause 88 deals with the establishment and the jurisdiction of the one-stop child assistance.
This one, if you feel it's not supporting, we can stop here. Because I know it may be there's too much on you. If you feel you need a break more than this, we can deal with the other stuff and then you come back later. I show you as you want to continue. Oh, well, you never get such a kind chairperson in this parliament. So you can take advantage of that and then it's up to you. Okay, continue, yes.
We're now looking at stuff. 89 deals with the establishment and jurisdiction of the one-stop child justice centers. Clause 89 allows the Minister of Justice to establish one-stop child justice centers. This must be done in consultation with other ministers, the Minister for Social Development, the Minister for Safety and Security and Correctional Services. The object of this centers is to promote cooperation between government departments and between government departments and the NGO sector, and also to ensure an integrated and holistic approach in the implementation of this legislation. The child justice centers must have a child justice court and may have other facilities, such as offices for use by SAPS, offices for use by probation officers, and facilities to accommodate children temporarily, and offices for use by legal representatives, and offices for use by diversion service providers, and a children's court.
the Minister for Justice may define the area of jurisdiction of a child justice center, a one-stop child justice center, which may consist of a number of magisterial districts. Each government is severally responsible for the provision of resources and services in these centers. And another clause to note is clause 92, which deals with children used by adults in committing offense. The clause provides that if it comes to the attention of the court during the proceedings that the child before the court has been used by an adult to commit an offense, an offense referred to in Schedule 1 or Schedule 2 of the Criminal Procedure, and these are serious offenses in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act. The court official to whom this comes.
Let me, in fact, I wanted to stop the questions now. And I want to take a presentation that that will deal with that will deal with the implementation strategy. I won't say that presentation now, but let me check first how long it's going to take so that maybe I can deal with Rika. But if they are ready to take us through, let me check how much time they need, because we are going to sit until 9 today, depending on so how strong are we going to be. We'll be doing this. Is it you, Sharon?
Yes.
How much time do you need on this one?
I was going to suggest that perhaps we take a break. It's about 10 to 15 minutes. It depends also on the questions that come out. So I was going to protest because you promised that we would get our chance, and then I said I was worried about the danger of that. But then you said the formal briefing was over and this was part of it in terms of implementation. So I think a lot of the questions we have answered that could be very brief.
Colleagues, on the very last clauses that were being taken through, immediately after the presentation by Sharon, you'll be allowed to ask any questions in terms of the bill as presented by Madame's person. You can ask any questions relating to all the clauses in this bill, coupled with the questions that are going to pose in terms of the content of this presentation that will be given to us. She is promising me that she does not need more than 10 minutes, because some of the questions that we're asking, in fact, are contained in the presentation. With your commission colleagues, can you allow me to allow Sharon to continue? We'll ask questions in the whole thing. Now, maybe let me be fair to colleagues, because I said it is cold here and there. It seemed not to be fixed. I would say maybe I'll use my traditional powers to give some instructions so that this must be stopped, because we're freezing here. Now, there is fresh tea there. This time I'm going to say people must just sneak out and grab a cup. We're breaking for 5 minutes. Yeah, let's break for 5 minutes. Let's have, enjoy our fresh tea so that I consult widely and see what we are going to do from here onwards while Sharon is getting busy. Can we break for only 5 minutes? Strictly, please. And enjoy a fresh tea day. Okay. Back to Rika. There was some bilateral negotiations, not between ZANU-TF and MDC, but between Justice and SARS, they agreed that they will waive their time to deal with the presentation now and allow the other component, that is SARL, to continue with the taking us through the amended the agreed amended losses on the RICA bill. Without any waste of time, I will therefore, as we agreed before I then this morning, allow SARL to go through, to take us through the versions that weren't removed in the bill or that weren't included in the bill. Over to you, SARL.
Thank you, Chairperson. We did hand out a new copy of the bill that was distributed this morning. If you can go to page 6, paragraph G, we discussed this morning, has been removed. That relates to the definition of roaming. Section 41 has been redrafted to take out the concept of registration of roamers. It currently reads, subject to paragraph B, an electronic communication service provider provides a mobile cellular electronic communication service, shall not activate a SIM card on the electronic communication system unless subsection 2 has been complied with. Then the proviso in paragraph B, paragraph A does not apply to a customer of an electronic communication service provider who provides a mobile cellular electronic communication outside the Republic and who enters the geographical coverage area of a mobile cellular electronic communication service provider in the Republic and use the electronic communication system of such provider to make, receive, send, voice calls or data, access other services. That is mainly in paragraph B, we stipulate that Section 40 will not be applicable to roamers. The further amendment to Section 40 was, I think I did explain it this morning, was to get rid of the mandatory...
Talk to clauses, I think that will make that easier for us.
Yeah, I'll explain it in Section 40 as a whole now.
That is clause what?
It's clause 2, Section 40.
Yeah, refer to clauses, I think that will make that easier.
Okay. On page 7, it's the proposed section 42. We did delete the requirements that the IMEI number and the IMSI number be recorded and stored beforehand or before a SIM card is activated. Certain consequential amendments were affected to the proposed section 40 or clause 2 to delete the requirement or the reference to cellular phone. I'm just going to go through the major amendments. There's obviously a lot of consequential amendments. It is indicated in the draft. Yes, if there's a question, just stop me and ask me a question, okay? The next major amendment to clause 2 is the deletion of subsection 9, which was also applicable to roamers, and that's on page 11. It was struck through. It's subsection 9, clause 2, page 11. On page 11 again, a new subsection has been proposed.
I see you are busy paging. Are you able to follow?
Page 11.
On the I mean the document. On the new document.
A new clause that is proposed is that an electronic communication service provider must on its electronic communication system record and store every MSISDN number with every IMEI number and every IMEI number used with every MSISD number, which must in production of a direction be provided to an applicant within 12 hours. Due to the fact that we actually in subsection 2, which was on page 7, we deleted paragraph B in C. Clause 9 was inserted to ensure that that information is in any event stored electronically by a telecommunication service provider. That is one of the new amendments. On a previous occasion, subsection 10 was already explained in the committee, and that is where we said that the information recorded, and that is on page 12, it's subsection 10. The information recorded and stored in terms of subsection 2 and 6 must be stored by electronic communication service provider for a period of 5 years. From the date when the customer cancels his contract or the electronic communication service provider ended his service. So it casts the positive obligations on mobile cellular operators to store this MSISDN number, the IMEI number, as well as the particulars of a customer for a period of 5 years. Also on page 12, the newly proposed section 40 that we discussed this morning has been deleted. And that goes to the end of page 13. Then there's a couple of consequential amendments to section 51 or clause 3 of the bill, which starts on page 14. I'm not going to explain that in detail. On page 15, it's clause 4, so the bottom of the page, amendment of section 62 of the Act. Currently, there's still a period of 12 months indicated in the clause. I think the chairperson did explain this morning that probably some kind of further consultation may be needed, but he feels that a period of 18 months must be given to mobile cellular operators to record and store the information of prepaid cellular clients. I can then take you to page 17. That is, clause 5, section 62C1. It was an amendment that was previously introduced in the committee, and it was just the extension of the current section that was approved by the National Assembly to also make it applicable to juristic persons. I'll take you through that one. It provides any juristic person having complied with section 42 and 62(6) and we provide a SIM card to a person in its employment must before handing over the SIM card to another person record the particulars as required in section 42 and the date and period for which the SIM card is provided. And B, verify the full name and surname, identity number and identity of the person to whom the SIM card is provided and furthermore, the address contemplated in section 43A3 by means of documentation contemplated in section 43B. Now, that is to make provision where juristic persons actually inter alia give SIM cards to the employees to inter alia do certain work for the juristic person where the SIM card and cellular phone is registered in the name of that juristic person. Furthermore, to that same section, On the next page, page 18, sections 4 and 5 has been added to that section. Section 4 provides that any applicant may, for the purpose of making application for the issuing of a direction in writing, request the person contemplated in subsection 1 or 2, that is a heuristic person or a natural person, to provide the applicant with the information recorded and stored in terms of subsection 1 and 2. And then furthermore, the person contemplated in subsection 1 and 2 receives the request referred to in paragraph A must immediately comply with that request if the request relates to any SIM card in its, his or her possession or to any person to whom the SIM card was provided or rented. And this is to assist the law enforcement agencies to find out precisely who, what is the identity of the person to whom the SIM card has been handed. And furthermore, the addition of subsection 5, if a person contemplated in subsection 1 or 2 knows or suspects that the identification document submitted for verification is contemplated in section 43 is false, it, he or she must within 24 hours report the matter to a police official at any police station. That's a similar provision in that already contained in section 40 and relates to the verification of the identity of a person to whom the SIM card is handed. That is the major amendments. Like I said, there are some consequential amendments. That concludes the chairperson.
Thanks, Sarah. Any thing from you, Dr. Jacobs?
Chair, thank you. No, I have nothing to add to that. Thank you.
Lauren? Ina? Colleagues, the bill is now as it was before we rejected it last year. It removed all those things that we didn't want then. Now the bill is exactly as it was before. But to give you a chance to further go and look as to whether are there some other things that will fall on the cracks that we might not have noticed. What we're going to do now is to allow Sarah and the department to go and clean it nicely, bring a clean copy tomorrow so that we're able to compare and vote on things that we're seeing based on each particular clause. Then we're going to pass it. Again, I am reliably informed that there was this bilateral by Sherin and Tarek, that tomorrow when we start with Rika to pass it with those clean clean versions. Then we continue with the child justice. Is there anything from you before I ask you to be accused or even to stay with us and stay and enjoy the meeting better? And Philip.
Thank you, Jane. If we can be excused, please, Jane.
Oh. Colleagues, Norman. Please don't ruffle feathers. You know, I've tried to calm in this water.
One quick question, Jane. Did I hear correctly that the department are willing to change that 12-month period for inception of this to 18 months? Am I correct in that assumption?
They'll change it from 12 to 18, as agreed by the committee last year. Honourable Van der Merwe? Honourable Mac? Nyanda? Abuntuli? Go for
it. Well, she might be a good now. I am a subscriber owner. I have Melan and I shall now in an alarm daughter. My mother would all kill it.
No, yeah, another one was saying, because I've been a good chairperson. It's proposed that all of us, after the meeting tomorrow, you donate some
make some contribution, you know. So it's a good gesture for me, just as being a good chairperson. That's what Mzizi was saying. No. No, he was saying if the service providers are happy with this kind of arrangement. he was just checking as to whether the service providers are happy with this kind of changes we're making. Now, I think we'll allow them to talk with the department outside this meeting. But even I see you've been joining my other people here. I didn't get a feel as to who is here. I can see other people here in that row where Kabsi, Pagamile, and Sean are. Those two gentlemen over there.
Christopher from MTN, Chair.
My name is Shimani Gareda from South Sea.
All the culprits are here. My goodness. Now, if there's anything, I think they'll raise it. Is there anything you want to raise? But I think you're happy with this kind of arrangement. Umzizi was just asking us whether you guys have anything to say about it. I think you are fine. If there's anything, you get a slot tomorrow if you want to raise anything. But I think you're fine. But if you want to raise something here for us to hear, feel free to raise it. But other than that, I think from this side, I think everything is fine. If there are things that you think need to be cleaned up or you want to try and plead or persuade the committee and the department to look into it from your viewpoint, feel free to indicate before we vote tomorrow. But for now, I think I can allow you to sit back, relax, and enjoy Child Justice Bill. Because I must allow the department to go and draft this new provision as agreed by the committee. Do I agree? Good. It's fine. You are accused in Sarel and Philip.
Thank you.
Until tomorrow. Thank you very much.
Okay, Philip.
Sherry, indicate when you are done with your bilateral with Sanderson. So it is bilateral. So that, I know they're assisting me, you know. Whatever is happening there, I know it's assisting me to make my life easy. Colleagues, as agreed, we're now going to listen to Sherin about the presentation on the implementation. If my team will be depleted simply because of this, the conditions in this room, continue, madam.
Thank you very much. See, apparently the overhead is not operational in this room. Says a lot for the beautiful environment. We have made copies for you. I'm afraid we lose some of the technological abilities that we've put together. And I've also noted, and my sincerest apologies, some mistakes on it because we had to print it rather quickly. What I'm going to go through, and I'm going to try and be as quick as I can because a lot of the questions have been answered. But I want to just put this in the context of what this bill aims to do. And what you will find very revolutionary about this bill, I think to use that as a term, is that it's brought different departments together in a way that is addressing the fragmented criminal justice system. You would know from prior history of the way criminal justice operated in terms of the operations and business process, each department manages itself without necessarily linking with what the other department would do. And that you would find in some of the questions that were asked today, like Home Affairs, SAP, Department of Justice, you can't, as an example, track a child from the minute that child has entered into the criminal justice system right through on the same documentation till the time that child would have been sentenced. Because we all use different business processes. We're also regulated by different pieces of legislation. And what this bill does, it brings that clustering and addresses so far on a policy perspective comprehensive integrated services, which is realizing the constitutional principles that human beings are indivisible. We can't divide you up. So as a child, when I come to you at SAPS, I don't say, give me SAPS services. I need a service, and all of us have got to respond. And this bill now brings that to the fore. That is why when we look at the preamble, you will see when it says recognizing on page one, it recognizes the historical challenges. One of the honorable members this morning, in as much as it was a one-sentence point, was very appropriate and very intensive in that we need to look at the causes of crime and respond in that manner. And that's what you will find the spirit and ethos is captured in the preamble. I know, Che, you said no preambles, but it's very important when we lose track of how to interpret other provisions in the bill that we read the preamble to keep us connected to what the spirit of the bill is. And you will see in the first paragraph, it recognizes historically where we've come from as a country. And those systemic issues we are still faced with, as you've seen, many children then becoming criminalized into the system. The point further about recognizing the realities of crime and being proactive in crime prevention is therefore also captured under what this Act aims to achieve. And very importantly, it also looks at creating incremental procedures. So it's not a one big bang approach that we can achieve within a period of a year. We need to take into account that the resources of the state are not as exhaustive as we'd like them to be. And so we also have recognized that there are those capacity, resource, and other constraints which is captured there under acknowledging that. And we put in a pragmatic incremental strategy. So as much as the bill would require implementation and a whole plan and an operational framework to be put in place within its first year, I think 5 years thereafter, you're going to see a far better looking implementation than in the first year because it has to be progressive. So when we say we would have 400 or so probation officers, it will also depend, because I think whether the question of if we then use more of the diversion services, we will then reduce the number of children going through full trial, and will you still have the same number of children going through the system and instead put more emphasis on crime prevention? So if you look at the first slide, it really acknowledges those as principles. Another very important principle which the bill recognizes and makes a point about is parental support. Because we as a country have, and I think the examples that were presented, which is true, is in cases where children are lucky enough to have their parents and caregivers and guardians, and mind you, just in quick response, guardian is a completely different term which during the discussions we must talk about and explain a little further, because I think that came up as a question on more than one occasion as to why we're talking about suitable parents, suitable adults, and appropriate adults. It's because not in all cases do children have the usual community support and family support, because some of them have lost their parents. But very importantly, in cases where there are parents and the dysfunctionality of society, the emphasis is that we've got to then instill different types of parenting skills. And you see the Children's Act, which this bill must not be read outside of, the Children's Act, Amendment Act, is very strong on parenting and looks at parenting plans, looks at how we can support society to improve the way we've managed our children from a parenting point of view. So that's a responsibility, and that is why that ethos has been kept in this bill, and Tanda went through some of those aspects of parenting and parental assistance, because if we left that, we will then contribute ourselves to the dysfunctionality of our family support. What the bill also emphasizes is the monitoring and evaluation system, which I've gone through to a large extent in the discussions today, so I'm going to skip that. If I go through the third slide, and I've mentioned this as well, is the Intersectoral Committee on Child Justice, which is in essence 10 years old, 12 years rather, 12 years in operation, but you will see that our child justice for at the provincial level is only a year and a half old. What we have done, and I'm going to explain also, that what this bill does is for the first time also includes, and it's keeping the principles of the Convention on the Rights of the Child, which is the only international human rights instrument that recognizes the role of civil society organs. And we've borrowed that principle from the Convention, also recognizing that in our own country, civil society organizations and NGOs have been very supportive in bringing child justice, keeping the issues of child justice alive, and using their technical support. You will see that entrenched particularly in the framework and also in the objects clause, which says that we must use a supportive civil society for best cooperation, to foster cooperation, and use as much skill in addressing children, matters that affect children that are in conflict with the law. Currently in progress with the ISCCJ is that we have government departments. This bill then also brings the Department of Health into the criminal justice environment formally, because it includes issues of psychological trauma and assessment. We also have the Department of Labor now on our committee, which is not traditionally one of the criminal justice agencies because of the recognition of the numbers of children that are used by adults to commit crime. In addition, as I was saying with the NGOs, we have the National House of Traditional Leaders. There was concern raised about when we brought in restorative justice, are we being very Eurocentric? And we've got to recognize that a lot of matters that are currently diverted are diverted, and if 20 million people fall within the traditional system of justice, then we have diversion programs that are managed by traditional systems. And so as a way of bringing this to the fore, we've included the National House of Traditional Leaders. The Chapter 9 institutions sit on our committee at present, as well as a range of other institutions like the Child Justice Alliance. So that's currently in operation and gives you a sense of how we've managed to so far use the kind of resources around us. Those committees meet on this ISCCJ meets on a monthly basis, and our meeting would have been tomorrow, Chair, but because we respect this committee enough, we cancel that entire governmental and non-governmental meeting for this month in view of your committee sitting today. We have that as a standing meeting every month on a Thursday. It used to be on a Wednesday, but now it's on a Thursday, to incorporate our provincial fora joining us at the national office. Now, the way we've organized, and you would have seen, even though this is a justice bill, the different departments coming, and I must say, and I never stop to commend the different departments in the spirit in which they pull together, because traditionally when a department presents its bill, it's the department's role. But in just about every meeting, and I must say social development, and even though I also disagree a lot with, we agree to disagree as a learned colleague, with NPA, there are almost always there at every meeting. The same with my colleagues from SAPS, but today they had other challenges and Department of Correctional Services. We almost always report collectively. We consult each other, even when we agree to disagree, but we consult each other, and even when we submitted our budgets for this current, for the next cycle, MTF, which Mr. Marcelli Seller mentioned on several occasions today, whilst our programming was not as effective, our time periods to put budgets together was done in a collective way. So it's one of the few times where we have consulted with each other's departments so that when we come to implement this bill, we have the necessary resources. So it's a question now of Treasury responding to us. Our subcommittees, just to give you an indication in terms of the concerns you may have about implementation, and of course there are still challenges. We are looking at putting in systems, firstly moving from a manual to automated system is not automatic. The business processes are different, legislation is different, directions and policies are all different. So we've got to do that alignment now. But we've already started that process. So in terms of our methods of work, we have different subcommittees, which you will see on slide 5. The first one is the awaiting trial subcommittee, and the one I'm referring to now in particular is that of the information management committee. It's taken us a year now to just pull together in terms of definitions. Because you would have had a definition of a child, a definition of a juvenile, and I think we were using the term rather loosely in the past 2-3 days about the definition of a youth. So we need to be compatible in terms of the systems because we've not all had the same definitions being regulated by different acts. And this one now makes it comprehensive and enables us to have the kind of legal framework. And there was also a question, I think, about justice, the different types of systems. We aim to have an integrated justice system at large, but this one for child justice is being fast-tracked. So we would be enabled to then track the child, and we're working rather feverishly on pulling those systems together. Even though this bill has not been implemented yet, the first process we started a year ago, which we'll now fast track, and already we've had 2 rounds of meetings, working sessions rather, looking at how we integrate our data to ensure the kind of case flow and look at analysis. 2-3 years.
Sharon, you are left with 5 minutes.
Okay. Two, three years ago, we would not have been able to give you the kind of trends in terms of reducing the numbers of children. If you look at our waiting trial subcommittee, we've reduced the numbers of awaiting trial children by 50% because of the intense monitoring. And you will also find that we're seeing that number on the decrease because we now have options available in terms of diversion services, home-based supervision, etc. The Child Justice Awareness Task Team also is looking at concerns about simplifying the bill and ensuring that there's sufficient information so people know how to interact appropriately. Chair, if you look also at the, in terms of just the child, realities and the section numbers, this is already implementing sections 94 and 96 of the bill. I'm going to skip on the monitoring and evaluation framework system because I think I've touched that quite a bit in terms of some of the deliberations earlier. And just to show the importance and the emphasis of the Director General Intersectoral Committee, which is already there in practice, because on a monthly basis we must report to the JCPS cluster, which is the cluster of the Directors General. What they've already done, in fact, came after the fact, is they've delegated that function to us as Chief Directors. The bill has now elevated it to the Directors General having to meet on a monthly basis. You also heard about the one-stop child justice centers. I've spoken about the reduction of children. The secure care facilities, which we said we're linking to the one-stop child justice centers, and we kept mentioning that of Narina and Mangaung. Those are the only two that we planned, we've rolled out already. And the rest we will roll out, which is a cost saver for government at large, because if you recall, each center cost us 20 million to set up. and we've set up only two centers. If we set up the 14 that was envisaged, you can imagine it would have cost us another 200 million. But locating it and linking it with the secure care facilities means we don't have to put up a whole court. We put up a seat, which will bring the cost down considerably. Instead of using 200 million, we would have used a whole lot less and perhaps used the money better for crime prevention strategies. In terms of including, a common concern we have is when you can't send the child to the family, send them to secure care. We have now resolved that in terms of our bed spaces in secure care facilities, because the rollout plan, which budget has already been approved by Treasury last year, is to roll out another 20 additional secure care facilities over and above the 31 that we currently have. And we've seen now, in terms of keeping children out of correctional facilities, that the bed spaces are on the increase because there are places the children can actually go. And this is done by us as a committee sitting and deliberating on what are the best options. Another challenge that we had is that we've got very limited reform schools in the country. Until they are built, we're looking at using secure care facilities where they would be adapted to keep in line with the prescripts of a reform school, and we've already agreed between the two departments, as a result of the structure sitting and discussing on a collective basis how can we resolve the problem, that we asked presiding officers to consider using different methods of sentencing until more reform schools are built. So what this is telling you is we have just, in a period of the last 2.5 years, changed around most of the systems and changed the numbers of children going through the system. You also will see our sentenced youth, the numbers coming down in terms of being imprisonment, because we have now created a whole lot more non-custodial options. And what this bill will do is regulate that from a legal perspective, give us the legal framework so that we can now have more options. In terms of, so I may go to the last slide then, on page 10, training and development. Training, which is the biggest challenge in terms of mindset, has already, we started with the process of restorative justice, and it's included in our Justice College annual training. A child law manual on the old child justice bill, which is on slide 10, has already been developed. Obviously, it will have to be updated to take into account the principles in this new bill, together with the magistrate's bench book. And we already started the process now of setting up the review for the child justice bill. There were questions about the preliminary inquiry. If I move on to the next slide, if you look at our Mangaung test site, where the preliminary inquiry is the only place where we've tested this, of the cases that came through court, only 15% went to full trial. Whereas now you process through the whole system, we found different options to send you, and we're finding that we've reduced the number of full trials. So instead of you spending your time going through a trial, you have less, more time to deal with those matters that are really serious properly, and the other types of diversion options, or other options that are available in terms of the inquisitorial process, have enabled us to reduce the number of trials and reduce the number of children in detention and are going through the system. Trial processes, from the department's point of view, we have those systems in place. Again, it's a question of training. In terms of criminal capacity, new obligations that would come out is where we have to put up more expert witnesses, even though we're finding that the numbers are reducing because more children are having possession of their identity documents. So in terms of additional human resources, we will require more magistrates, prosecutors, and to a large extent, clerks. But with the incremental approach and also with the systems in place, we are able to manage and track the case flow that is there. And my last slide, Chair, I'll end on this note, in terms of where our biggest challenges are. Time is going to be a bit of a factor in terms of pulling the national policy framework together. Joint reporting, our PFMA, as much as it says each department is accountable on its own, we have, from a policy perspective, already decided and agreed where we can collectively collaborate. The other challenges we would have is both for our personnel and the general public to understand the principles of restorative justice. So when it appears like we are being soft on crime, you'd find that it is much more challenging to be accountable and face, in terms of the victim-offender mediation, we find the success rate where you have to then account to the victim, what, depending on the circumstance, of course, or where you taught about accountability, because you come from a dysfunctional background, the success rate and the rate of reoffending is much lesser. And then, of course, the child rights culture, just going into a human rights culture, that mindset and social context, which we've located in the directives, certainly you can't change mindset overnight. It will take a process and requires a lot of interaction. So those would be our major challenges for now. So, Chair, I think with some of the questions that will come through later, if I have not covered most of these, would have taken, I would say, taken us through some of the processes that are already in place. And I must say, as a person in the Department of Justice, as an official in the Department of Justice, chairing several other portfolios in the category of vulnerable groups in the child rights sector, I have found that the most amount of cooperation and the cohesiveness in just trying to remedy and address the challenges has really been phenomenal, especially towards making this bill work. You can see it in the discussions and the way the whole processes have gone thus far in terms of trying to get the best kind of support from wherever, because the commitment from just about every official, as much as we have challenges, is let's try and find the best way out of this and let's come up with the kind of solutions to remedy the challenges. And the most exciting thing, I think, is that people are recognizing that we must give our children opportunities even where they have offended, but let's help them out of the system so we can prevent them from reoffending and really becoming productive citizens. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Sharon, for the presentation that further explains the task before all of us and all the plans that are put in place to try and implement the provisions in this bill. Thank you very much, Madam. It's exactly 5. On that note, colleagues, I will be unfair to you today. I won't allow you to ask any questions now, but then please just underline your question. I can see you've been making notes while she was addressing us. Let's keep those questions until tomorrow. What time do you want to